Hi, this is Corvin Russell. I'm an activist, writer, and educator based in Toronto. On Monday, October 28th, I talked to Carlos Torres, a comrade and longtime activist of the Chilean left who lives in Santiago, to learn more about the wave of protests that has been gripping the country for the last few weeks. Carlos spent many years in Montreal and Toronto doing social justice and international solidarity work, including serving on the World Social Forum International Council. He's also written three books, one on Che Guevara in the 21st century, one titled Venezuela, Democracy or Dictatorship, and a book on the revolutionary left in Chile. Carlos and I also had a short follow-up interview this past Monday, November 4th, to talk about the developments in the days before. As you listen to the conversation, I invite you to consider three questions. One, is the crisis in Chile a crisis of neoliberalism or a crisis within neoliberalism? Two, what are the implications for the nature of the political subject required to challenge neoliberalism and transform the state? Do we see the beginnings of possibilities of a new kind of historical subject whose universality consists in an articulated subjectivity rather than in a reductive universal politics? To what extent does a need for a mass political instrument like the old mass parties of the left remain insurmountable? Three, what might be revealed about the limits and continuities of U.S. imperial power and the rise of alternative capitalist powers? I began the conversation by asking Carlos about his involvement with resistance to Pinochet in 1973 and the years following, and how he escaped the country for Canada.
I was a young student those days. I ended up in jail, and I spent time in clandestine life before being taken by the Pinochet police, and I was taken to a military tribunal in wartime, as they call it. We were identified as prisoners of war, condemned in a military tribunal, released later in Chile, and taken again. I was taken again by the police in 76, released, and with the help of the church, of the Chilean church, I ended up in Argentina, and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees brought me to Canada. Montreal. The Quebec government had a rescue plan for former political prisoners, both in Chile and in Argentina or neighboring countries.
And that was the Péquiste government in Quebec?
The Péquiste.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I see. So you actually came a little bit later as a convention refugee.
Exactly.
Okay. And when did you return to Chile?
About 12 years ago.
Right. And now, maybe why don't you just describe the current situation in Chile for listeners, the recent wave of huge protests, which have, you know, broken through to international media. What's it like there right now?
Well, a little bit of an intro will be useful in this regard. After the coup d'etat in year 73, around year 75, the Choc Doctrine, as Naomi Klein presented, was implemented in Chile. So unions' rights were prohibited, and the political party on the left became illegal, and the privatization of most of the sector of the economy that used to be in state hands were privatized to benefit private sector, both mostly national at the beginning, and later both national and international. So people's rights, that people, all kind of rights for health and education, pensions and so on, were abolished by the dictatorship. And it's like the people, the social organization, unions and students organizations had to start all over again to try to regain or reclaim and to regain rights. First of all, during the dictatorship and later during the transition time, and which took us to today. I mean, if you look at the Chilean case, everything in Chile is privatized, from water, forest, fishing rights, education, health, and name it. So people have really been, quote unquote, vandalized by the market. I call this as a second plus value, because people are taking profit from their work extensively, and then through credits and through finances. People live here indebted to the next generation. That's the way they manage to survive and to overcome poverty.
Well, and that's interesting because in a way that's increasingly the truth everywhere in the world, but maybe in that respect, as in many others, Chile has actually been the sort of laboratory or the vanguard of neoliberalism right from the beginning. I mean, it was sort of the testing ground for neoliberal reform after the Pinochet coup, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, exactly. They started it with, as I said, and they call it that way, the shock doctrine at the time, ported, of course, ideologically by the School of Chicago, led by Milton Friedman at the time and supported ideologically by Hayek's and others. So Chile became a lab, and they could do that basically because they did it under a dictatorship. Otherwise, because of extensive struggles and organizations in Chile, they could have done it if in a democratic or open context. So through that time, people, unions and workers, for instance, have not recovered or recouped the standard of living they used to have in the year 73, to mention one case. Unions have been practically diminished by labor organizing here because of production had been relocalized to China mostly. The entire industrial setting and manufacturing that used to be in Chile do not exist anymore. So that managed to weaken proletarian or labor organization organizing, and we ended up by having a very weak unions and very weak organizations to protect people's rights.
And the economy now is mostly a commodity economy, kind of like Canada in a way. Am I correct in that?
You are correct. And it's been the case of Chile for almost forever. Although in the 50s, 60s, the ECLAC, the Economic Commission for Latin America of the United Nations, tried to implement some form of export-led industrialization. But it did work at some point, but it didn't manage to consolidate itself because of the coup d'etat and they claimed the size of the market. So we're still exporting copper, and now we add fruit, fishing, forestry, and basically unfinished products. So,
and all those are in private hands, is that?
And it's mostly in private, both national and international hands.
So at some point, I mean, the left, did it survive clandestinely through the Pinochet years? At some point, it burst to public awareness, I think, in North America with the student mobilizations, which I think took place around 7 years ago now, or is that 20?
Yeah, they have been after the dictatorship through the process, they call it transition to democracy, which is not there yet. We never managed to achieve democracy because the institutional setting is based on the Pinochet constitution. So you need overwhelming majority in the Senate and in the deputies chamber to approve laws that will question the role of the market in society. I mean, Chile is a market society led by interests of companies that managed to create a new wealthy community and a different kind of wealth in a strong association or with the international mining companies, for instance, in most of the Anglo countries, or water processing in France or Spain, all kind of retail products like Walmart is overwhelmingly present in Chile. And so on.
And so what's the nature? Is there a social welfare state? How do people survive if you're jobless or if you're retired, what are the provisions or how is healthcare managed?
Well, everything that, air is still free here, okay? But it's so contaminated because the kind of economy we have in Chile contaminate water, lands, and everything that you can breathe from. Now, so the income is very slim at present time. I mean, imagine that in Canada, if I'm not wrong, the minimum wage average per month is about $2,000. Okay? In Chile, I will sustain that it's about a third of that. While the prices in Chile, the standard of living in Chile is as costly as it is in Canada. So that's it, just to make a parallel on this. So people, I mean, the whole family works, and people are disciplined, as Stephen Giles or others claim, have been disciplined by neoliberal policies. So the neoliberalism give you access to the market, give you access to debt, but you have to pay for that. So in terms of paying everything that you can consume, you have to work 12 to 14 hours a day. Okay? So people are worked to, I mean, like back to the slavery time, and beyond working, you don't have energy, you don't have mind of organizing or coming home to read, to inform yourself. So this attraction, this kind of a fatal attraction that the market provides to society, makes people like to forget that they're citizens or members of a community, and they become mostly consumers. And consumers become the identity of individuals in Chile. So people manage to survive. But for instance, last year, more than 20,000 people die waiting for what they call it here, waiting list for hospitals, surgery, or transplant, or major operations. Okay? So people that do not manage to pay or to have money to pay for health, they will just die.
So there really isn't a public healthcare sector. There's no universal
guarantee. There is one. Yeah. No, there is one. There is one. But by constitution, it cannot be allocated too much money to it. Okay? So it's like a healthcare system that is in public control, but with a very little budget. And constitutionally, it cannot be, more money cannot be allocated. And budget will not be, the hospital will not have enough budget to look after ill people.
So that's the sort of situation in Chile that is the backdrop to the current wave of protests. How did these protests start, and what were the motivating issues?
Well, through the past 10 to 15 years, there have been mobilization and struggles for different issues in Chile that can come to an account of 30 to 40 issues, from water, forestry, fishing, contamination, women issues, student loans, labor laws, minimum wage, 40 hours shift fight for the week shift, and so on. There are many women issues, type patriarchal issues. Gay community have been mobilized as well. Immigrants, new immigrants coming to Chile. So a large number is, it's an overwhelming number of issues that you can find in every aspect of society, in every aspect of your life. And people have been mobilizing, educating on these matters for several years. And this issue of fare, the hike of the subway fare, it was like the last straw.
And that was in Santiago, you know, specifically?
Specifically. And there is a tradition here that high school students have been always mobilizing and struggling. Since since I was myself high school student, we were organized, we used to mobilize and so on. So at this point in time, with this hike, for the subway hike, students, high school students decided to evade the payment, okay? So they jump over the turnstiles.
Yeah.
And they managed, a massive evasion of the fare began in different subway stations. What the government did was to send the cops, the special forces, as they call it, or special units, to repress and to beat up the students.
And when did that start, the repression?
Around October 12 to 14, during that week. Until the people reacted. I mean, passengers and users of the subway began to resist and to protect the young students, and the fight began with repression, with the police. And in every subway station, the government decided to shut down the subway and some subway stations, and people started by breaking in through this gate, and in many cases, to set on fire these subway stations, to the extent that about 40 to 50 subway stations were both vandalized or set on fire.
And that was again 2 weeks ago?
About 2 weeks ago.
I see. And that sort of all happened within the space of a couple of days? Just
yeah, within a week. Within a week, this evasion process started, and the government launched a brutal repression against them. And people began to react, to set barricades, and then to loot food chains, food markets, Walmart mostly, not exclusively, and so on. And the confrontation with the cops, to the extent that the government decided to enact the state of emergency, as they call it, and then to establish a curfew.
And is that when the military was deployed?
Exactly. And with the military in the city that are not used to deal with this, brought back the, you know, the dictatorship threat, and people resisted overnight, resisted during the day, and massive mobilization started from one end to the other of Chile.
And was the provocation the return of the military to the streets? Was that the provocation?
A further provocation, because provocation started with repression against the students that evaded the subway to pay the subway.
And so you were saying 2 million people were in the street.
2 million people were in the street last week across the country, and that was a turning point. People noticed and realized they could do more. The government tried to launch a small package of reforms, and this did not calm down the people. I would say people were more than pissed off at this point in time, and people still very pissed off at the government and the political system.
And what were the reforms the government offered? I guess the first question is really what, and just because you said 2 million people were on the streets, for listeners' perspective, the population of Chile is about 18 million, I think. And so
exactly, 17 more, and change.
More than 10% of the population is on the streets. And yeah. Are there clear demands being made? I mean, when 2 million people are on the streets, obviously there's a huge array of social forces, but, you know, from what classes who's participating in these protests, and are there clear demands that have come forward that the government tried to respond to or maybe split the mobilizations with?
Oh, well. At the beginning, it was mostly young people on the street. Young people, let's say, between 15 to 30 years old. The demands at the beginning it's been for a long time, the issue of education, health, pension, housing, environmental issues, and so on. And I can unfold more issues on. It's a long list of issues. And the government offered a small pack of reforms. And people were not happy. I mean, they offered a small pack of, let's say, 20% increase of pension for someone who's making $200 a month, a retiree person making $220 or $240 a month. That doesn't change too much, especially for the cost of living in Chile. So the government tried to offer subsidies for this and for that. And most of the subsidies and the reforms would be funded by the state, by public funding, but would be processed and commercialized by private sectors. So again, the reforms could be paid by the state, but processed and commercialized by private sector, 90% of it. So people were not happy with that.
Is that because public infrastructure has largely been privatized?
Exactly, and contracted out, subcontracting and contracting out. Everything here is contracted out. So people, the day after is when the 2 million took to the street across the country.
I see. So after this package of reforms that nobody was happy with.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
It didn't work. And people now are clearly demanding for a new constitution, for a constituent assembly, and for the government to step down and to call for elections. There are all kind of calls. I mean, the unions are calling for a general strike on Wednesday, and tomorrow a large demonstration around the government site, offices in downtown Santiago. Today, this morning, the government shuffled the ministries and recreate this ministerial body. People reacted in the afternoon, taking on the street in Santiago, Valparaíso, Antofagasta, Concepción, major cities of Chile. People showed that they were not happy, and that's still not happy. And I'm afraid that not only the government, but the political system is losing control of it, that people are not reacting to wishy-washy reforms.
So that raises two questions for me. One is maybe some sort of analysis of the ruling elements in Chile, the ruling classes, and their ability to respond to the protests and the underlying demands. I mean, do they have the ability and the will to reform the state and the economy to any meaningful extent? And then I guess the second part would be, if this is a crisis of the Chilean state and really a fundamental crisis of the state, then what about the subjective element of the protests? I mean, you know, the old Marxist way of saying it would be maybe the objective conditions of the revolution are present, but not the subjective condition. Although in the case of Chile, there hasn't really been an economic collapse. It's just an accentuation of inequality to the point where it's no longer tolerable. So is there an organization or leading force that can step in to sort of represent the forces of mobilization, or is anything like that coming together? So I guess that's a two-part question, the nature of the ruling classes and the subjective element of the
mobilization. Well, the ruling class here is most export-led business community. They have managed to consolidate their position in the global market with exporting, and in the regional setting, regional market financially. I mean, you will see now Chilean businesses based in Chile, Chilean-owned, investing in neighboring countries, including Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Argentina, and so on. Okay, the largest, like Air Canada, used to be in Canada, the Chilean airline joined with the giant Brazilian airline, and now they control most of the Latin American market. The flight, the travel, Latin American market. Just to mention one case, and our second case would be retail. The same thing, major store chains are based in Chile, and also have stores in the neighboring countries. So they've managed to accumulate enough money to invest even in neighboring countries, to the extent that the forestry companies have even own some processing plants, wood plants in Canada, U.S., and Brazil, and other Latin American countries.
And so
all that is possible. Let me explain this.
Yeah.
But this is important. All that is possible because pension funds, money that people contribute on a monthly basis to their pensions, is managed by private sector. So they get fresh capital that they can lend on a regular basis to the local business, to Chilean businesses, and paying little interest to the workers that are paying their monthly dues to these pension funds. But at the end of their retiring term, they don't have enough money to survive. But through all that time, 10, 20, 30 years, they use this fresh cash, the free, I mean, very cheap money, to invest in the country and in the neighborhood. Okay? So that is a huge pot of money that deprived workers for a good pension, retirement pay, but is invested by Chilean companies. So that's the nature of the Chilean economy in many ways. That's why the movement against no more private pension fund is so strong in Chile, and it's across the board, and it's one of the main actors of this resistance against neoliberal policies. Now, so the ruling elite here encompass also the old progressive left, that became very, very neoliberal in so many ways, because they rotate from the parliament or state jobs to companies, boards, or jobs. They commute from one setting to the other, from the, either from the state or from the private sector. So that is a very pervasive case with the Chilean elites, both politically and financially. Now, the answer to this crisis, because this is like multi-head, it's multi-led by different local groups and regional groups, and there is some coordination of not of tactics, but of momentum or timing to implement activities. But there is a real diversity of tactics. In this context, a little bit earlier than perhaps a month ago, a platform of social unity was created. And this platform includes unions, the central trade unionist, environmental groups, peasant organization, native organization, women, students organization, unions, from mining to construction, to the dock workers, fishermen, and all miners, as I said, all kind of organization, about 100 organizations came together, and they're part of what they call the translation will be more or less social unity platform. And at present time, they have a list of demands to deal with the crisis in terms of reforms, but including political changes that goes from a referendum to recall the constitution and to call for a constituent assembly. And that is the subjective force, if we can call it on leftist terms, confronting the crisis from the people's side. The left is a little bit institutional here and behind on the process, the left in general. And the far left is weak at the present time and try to get involved in the process and trying to play a role, even a vanguardist role, but is not there yet.
It does it have the legitimacy to do that?
Little.
Right. And one of the things that I recall seeing is that, I mean, you've mentioned that the government tried with some modest reforms maybe to break away fractions of the population who might have been satisfied with that, but that didn't work. And then the other thing they tried is to sow division by denouncing or pointing up the use of vandalism and calling those people violentistas. But yeah, that also doesn't seem to have really divided the opposition, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, not yet. But I think that is a plan. It's a plan for the government to try to criminalize sectors of the protesters and to isolate them from the massive protest. Now, we have to acknowledge that about 95% of people demonstrating against the neoliberal, now it's clear that it's against neoliberal reforms, are mobilizing with peaceful meaning. There is a number of individuals that will not only confront the police, which are repression, which I don't think that there is a problem with that, but that will get involved in looting and pillaging stores and so on. But you know what? The issue here is that people have been vandalized their lives by the ruling elite for such a long time that at the end of the day, it's not even a moral or an ethical issue. Because the ruling elites have done it for such a long time, they have created such a misery in people's life that people feel that they have the right to fight back and to take back a proportion of what they have been stolen.
Right.
From
the ruling classes have looted the people, and yeah, so now the people have the chance to get some of it back. Now, well, so where next? We're talking late on Monday night, and there's a big protest planned for Tuesday. Is there a sense of where this is going?
Well, that is a tricky move, because surrounding the government building is like taking the Winter Palace in the old Russian.
So that's the mobilization for tomorrow to surround the government. I see.
is surrounding the government building, and I'm not sure what is going to happen. But my taking after witnessing what happened today is that people indeed will make it, and up to where the government is able to deal with, I'm not sure, because they have two options. Either they protect, they barricade themselves around this building, or they launch and they release a strong repression that could end up in some form of butchery, because people are extremely upset, pissed off with the system and with the government. People are calling for the president to step down.
It's already been quite bloody so far, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, more than 20 people have been killed, over 3,000, 3,500 people been detained, hundreds of them tortured, more than 100 people are blinded now because they lose one eye at least through these small bullets, the plastic rubber bullets that the police use. So tomorrow's mobilization is going to be a move that could, in the government view, break the movement. But my taking is that it might mostly break the government, because the unity within the government forces is weak at present. The staunch neoliberals want to keep the model as it is, while there are more, if we can call it pink, neoliberals that are willing to introduce deep reforms to save the heart of their project and the heart of the model, which is in decay in the southern cone. I mean, Macri lost the election in Argentina today. Evo Morales was reelected again in Bolivia. In Ecuador, the indigenous people are really pushing the current president to a corner. And in Uruguay, the broad front or the Frente Amplio probably will retain office. That is not 100% sure. And Bolsonaro in Brazil, now with these mobilizations in the southern cone, will not feel very happy, and the mobilization against him already started. So in this specific case, the government had not been very wise to implement a reform that would deflect some of the mobilization or the protesters' aims, and to calm down the situation, given that the United Nations Human Rights Commission landed today in Chile, and they will be monitoring what's going on in this country on that matter. And there are two major events taking place in November and in December in Chile, the COP25 and the APEC meeting. So this is a tricky situation for the Chilean government. And I think that the context that is not working in favor of Piñera, because he will have to give up in many aspects if he wants to keep these two international events alive. Otherwise, he's going to be the government. Piñera himself will be lose this opportunity to show their neoliberal shine, which is really coming to a obscure situation as we speak.
Well, and I think it's maybe surprising in some ways, but for those elites, events like that are very important to their pride and their vanity. And so being able to protect those might be a motive for them to agree to serious reforms. Now, I mean, it seems in the case of Venezuela, we're seeing to some extent the limits of U.S. power to intervene. Not that Chile's in a case like Venezuela where the state is in the hands of the left, but it seems that other than economic levers and things like capital strike or financial measures, the ability of the U.S. to influence the course of these events has been fairly limited in South America recently.
Well, the U.S. has his agenda. It's always been there. It's the U.S. agenda as an imperial country to keep Latin America as their backyard, as we know. But lately, I think that they don't have too many options. I mean, I think the issue of hegemony and dominance interact and are at play now. I don't think that hegemony, the way we used to know it, is happening. The U.S. is not persuading or convincing Chilean and Latin American societies to go the U.S. directions. I mean, China, Russia, and even India have begun to have an important presence in Latin America in terms of in technology and financial and military aspects at this point in time. So with the Venezuela case for the U.S., I think it's been difficult, not only because of Venezuela managed to resist. I mean, they have been resistant for many years. It's so similar to what happened to Cuba without in bringing a comparative analysis between the two countries because processes are quite different. But the U.S. haven't, although they managed to try to create a Latin American isolation ring against Venezuela. I think that the Maduro government managed to survive that and to keep the country and the economy and the political settings afloat with a lot of difficulties for many reasons that has to do with blockade, embargoes, and their own probably wrongdoing in organizing the economy and so on. But nevertheless, I mean, the U.S. Did not manage to impose their view in Venezuela under this kind of Mickey Mouse president that they support, Guaido, didn't happen. They tried to do something similar in Peru and other countries, but this kind of soft coup d'etat doesn't work anymore. And the military, open military intervention, I don't think, because of the mess happening around the world, that the U.S. Will be able to do anything like that in Latin America. And there is more resistance to the U.S. Dominance as well from societies, not only from the left. I mean, this is spread out a little bit more. And I don't think that they can intervene in Chile at present. Although, if they need to, they will try. But the situation is, this is not the left. This is not the far left that is trying to bring down neoliberalism and Piñera. This is a broad movement that, in my view, you will find liberals and even right-wing individuals to the far left coming to the street and calling for Piñera to step down. So it's a very messy situation, which is difficult to explain in a traditional Marxist analysis or a Marxist way of looking at a political process. Objective conditions might be there. The subjectivity is not extremely active. I'm not saying that we are at the end of the neoliberal era in the case of Chile, and that this is not a crisis of neoliberalism. It's rather a crisis in neoliberalism. And they still have room to manage political and economic solutions that will maintain the system afloat. But I don't think they are flexible and wise enough to do so. So they are putting at risk their own project.
So it's really the incompetence of the bourgeoisie or the incapacity of the bourgeoisie to reform in its own interests, which is also a problem we're seeing across even the northern capitalist world. And perhaps it's a function of the absence of a left where it doesn't create the political space within which to achieve those compromises. I don't know, but just going back to what you mentioned before about the surrounding countries in Latin America, the narrative, certainly in the elite media in the last few years, was that the pink tide had abated and, you know, more centrist, as they say it, centrist governments had come in, although some of these governments, as in Brazil, are not centrist. Clearly, they're far right in character. But that seems to now be reversing and going the other way. I guess my question is, you know, if the neoliberal tide is going out again, are the left formations in these various countries just the same ones that were there before resuming their place in office, or have there been changes that might make outcomes different this time, or have there been lessons learned?
We have been thinking about all that. It's not an easy reflection because everything is there. I mean, everything you mentioned, Corbyn, is still part of the picture. There is a left that is trying to bring back to what we can call it a second pink tide, or to reform the left from a revolutionary view, but with a new content. I think there are lessons learned, mostly in terms of diversity, in terms of diversity of issues and themes, and in terms of a more democratic participation in some ways. And I think that the leading experience there is it's a Bolivian one, in the one hand. In the case of Brazil, for instance, the Workers' Party and the more broader left coalitions, I think they're going through a process of deep thinking or rethinking politics and about how to go for a transformation. Because that the first, if we can call it pink tide, probably it was based on the remains of the old left, trying to dress itself with a new narrative, with a new approach to transformation, but it's still very much based on all traditional political practices of the left. And I think that is, in that sense, there are lessons learned, mostly in countries like with a strong indigenous population, like in Guatemala, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Peru, to mention. So in which indigenous population and less Western-oriented, trying to bring about the whole idea of a new kind of civilizational politics is being part of the debate, in which Marxist and Christian indigenous and community-oriented projects are coming together. And one of the best expression of that is the landless movement in Brazil, which is still alive and trying to keep developing this kind of a more broader ideological project, if we can call it, in which they converge all these ideas. And another factor is that also the women participation in most of these processes, women not only as a social actors for the general demands, but also for their own demands and issues. We also have if we can call it a new actor here, which is the gay community, which is making their voice through the political processes in strongly so in Argentina and in Chile and Brazil as well. And the environmental issues are becoming more mature and more defined in terms of what they are confronted to as well, the whole industrial setting based on capitalist approach to development. So there is a learning process there, and the old generation is fading away in some form, and there is new generation of militants and participants that I think make me optimist that there's more new things to hope that will unfold in the following years.
Well, that's a great note to end on. And maybe one more thing I was going to ask, probably, you know, it feels like when you're sitting this far away, especially in Canada, there's not much you can do. There are solidarity protests that have taken place in various cities around the country. First of all, is there a way somewhere that you can recommend people to follow the news in Chile? And, you know, is there anything that's useful for people to do here to support and act in solidarity with protesters in Chile?
Thanks, Corbyn, for asking that. I mean, this is not going to be easy. This process, in some ways, is a new starting. It's like starting all over again, like my old friends used to say. What is required here is here and there is more education and more information about the importance of understanding neoliberalism and how it works beyond economic reforms, but also in cultural politics. And that is this experience of Chile. And I remember that I used to preach about that while in Canada, because when neoliberal politics come, it's a difficult animal to fight. So information and education is crucial for solidarity. If we understand solidarity in two ways, venue, we understand other realities, and we, by understanding that, we also understand our own reality, because we are not too far apart anymore. And one way of expressing solidarity is by also looking at human rights abuses in the case of Chile, and try to denounce that to international entities, and especially to the Canadian government, to take a stand. Union or organizations, the church or organizations, the student associations in Canada in regards to human rights abuses. I think that it'd be great that people can respond to that, but it would be also important to analyze these processes and to see how the threat of neoliberalism, which has been a threat for Latin American countries, is also a threat for all of us, including the Canadian society. So information tools can be found mostly in alternative media, because the mainstream, which often is owned by neoliberals themselves, they try to cover this, try to neutralize and to hide these mobilizations, which are not necessarily revolutionary, and that are not necessarily in the sense that we bring down the whole capital system. But for the time being, they're trying to bring back social justice and to establish a better societies, create the conditions for a better changes in the near future. But that's what we are at the present time. And that they should, the ones that are not persuaded of this, that social justice for the humans and for the environment and for all form of life is the more important thing we can do at present time.
Well, that's a great place to end. Carlos, thank you for your time. I certainly am pretty ignorant about goings on in Latin America these days, so I really appreciate the chance to talk to you. And if we can check in again later as developments occur, I think that would be very useful for people. So once again, thank you for your time. And is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
No, Corbin, just thanks for this opportunity. Thank you for your will to do this. And as you said, it'd be good if people can be aware and alert about what is going on here, because, every country in the world they get concerned when the international setting is aware or informed of what's going on, and that the countries are not as nice, or the governments are not as nice as we think they are. And that could be the case of Chile, and in some cases could be the case of the own Canadian government.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, thank you so much, Carlos. Talk to you later.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Corvin again. The next segment is a follow-up conversation I had with Carlos on the evening of Monday, November 4th, after a planned encirclement of the parliament and government buildings the previous Tuesday had been thwarted by massive tear gas deployment and water cannon suppression. In the intervening days, however, mass protests continued to build, and I asked Carlos for an update.
Well, Corbin, this is something that we didn't think about. This is very unexpected, but people have still demonstrating against the government and government mild reforms about this crisis. And it's true that we didn't manage to surround the government building or the parliament building, yet people still demonstrate and in everywhere, every day. Even last Sunday, a number of bike riders went to next to the president's Piñera home to protest. We're talking about several hundreds of people in bikes, okay, asking him to step down, to resign. And that's the nature. I mean, every day, every single demand or every community protest against the government. There is no stopping this. Today, we have a demonstration and a march of, 100,000, 200,000 people on the streets of Santiago. Again, mostly led by unions of all unions. We are talking here high school teachers, health workers, public sector workers, dock workers, miners, and everybody, and people at large. So the demonstration, although it slowed down in terms of participants, is still there in terms of issues, and people are now frankly asking for a constituent assembly to change the constitution of 1980, which was set up by the dictatorship during the Pinochet regime, and people want a new constitution that is democratic, participatory, and that people have a say in this constitution. But also, I think that the agenda is moving further even, and that people want Piñera to resign. I mean, he's very isolated. He's putting at risk the neoliberal agenda. And it wouldn't surprise me that even from the business community would agree on and having him as a casualty instead of risking the stability of the neoliberal system in Chile.
And do you think they would contemplate constitutional reform?
They've said, both the business community and the right wing, that they're willing to discuss everything. They're willing to constitutional reforms. They are not entirely sure about a new constitution, but people's strength and force today, I mean, is on the street, is on in striking, and oil workers are planning and a strike of Wednesday to stop not only refining oil, but oil distribution, okay, as of Wednesday. It's not sure whether or not this is going to happen. And mine workers are also talking about halting, putting a stop or slowing down mining production, mostly copper. So the government is really in shambles. And the government, Piñera, has not been seen on TV, on radio, or making any statement about what's going on at present. And it's been mostly ministers that have been explaining some of the government reforms and deals that they're trying to establish with the opposition, which is a large coalition of center-left political parties. But the last survey about popularity in Chile brought down the government, the president's support to 12%, and the political parties even lower. I mean, every institution of the state today is questioned by society.
Now, has the government in the meantime offered further concessions on top of the mild reforms they'd offered in the weeks before?
They are working on it, but they haven't been able to present a new package of reforms. They know that they have to go deep in the reforms, and that they have to cover many things, and even the business communities is willing to pay more taxes, to pay better wages, and to get involved also in contributing more to pension funds and so on. I mean, the business community understood that they've made so much money in the past 30 to 40 years that now that they have to open their pockets.
And one more thing, this made the international headlines. Piñera canceled the COP and APEC meetings in Chile. And what is the response to that been in Chile, both among the protesters on the left and on the right?
Well, this was going to be a very good opportunity for Piñera to become popular in Chile and elsewhere on the issue of the environment and the APEC issues. But pressure from social organizations. I mean, the instability is so great here that there is no room for international events. Any international events of any kind even a soccer tournament had been canceled. Chileans, you know, are crazy about soccer, like Canadians are crazy about hockey. But now, in the past 3 weeks, all soccer tournaments have been postponed and canceled, even, and even international soccer games. So what the issues here is that there is the government is so weak and unstable that they cannot warranty any kind of event that will bring people together. I mean, they're afraid that people will really question not only the events, but the very stability of the government. I mean, politicians and parliament are really under fire by the people. The only entity that do have a little bit, well, more than a little bit of respect from society is the firefighters. Everybody else from church down under fire.
I think I saw a meme online from Chile, and the caption was, there's a picture of a firefighter, and the caption was, the only person in uniform, uniformado, is that how you say that in
yeah.
The only person in uniform in Chile that the people respect.
Yeah, and that is the case. I mean, even politicians try not to go to the street or need to meet up with people or to do anything. They are really afraid of people's reaction. People are really pissed off.
And they don't obviously think that they can bring this under control very fast if they have canceled these major meetings.
They don't have the tools to do it at present. They don't have the imagination in terms of how to make a deal with the people, to make a deal with the political system, to make a deal with the economic community. They don't know what to do. I mean, whatever they do, is gonna question the stability of neoliberalism, and they don't want to do that. But people are pushing for it. People want a new constitution, a constitution that will allow deep reforms, that will allow bringing back natural resources or common goods into the public hands, and that the wealth that a country like Chile can produce will be better distributed across the board and among the population.
So it sounds like things are going to continue to unfold for quite some time. And maybe we can check in later as events have developed?
Sure. But let me tell you this. People are mobilizing. People are taken to the street by thousands, coming from every walk of life. This is not only about the left. It's not only about unions. It's not only about students or shantytown dwellers. This is about a society that are fed up with neoliberal reforms. And they understand now better because we have, and we call it cabildos here, which is our open meetings and assemblies in communities and workplace in which people are debating about this. And people are getting much better informed about where we are and what is the way out of it. People want to get out of this market economy, out of the market controlling the economy and the market controlling everyday life. People want to have a life which is free from the market and that would have an estate that do their job in terms of social programs and a better estate dealing with people's issues and better wealth and distribution.
Well, that's pretty radical in this day and age and also exciting. So I'm eager to hear more about where it goes. Thanks,
sure,
Carlos.
Sure, no problem, Corbin. Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Have a good night.